We are now for many months engaged in a series of Sunday night sermons in which we've been trying to examine some of the central important teaching of the Christian faith. And we have come through a series of segments in the course of the whole of the calendar year to this final segment in our series on truths to live by, in which we are thinking in this month of November about what Christians for centuries now have usually thought of as the four last things: the subject of death, the subject of judgment, the subject of hell, and the subject of heaven. Last Sunday evening, we thought together about the subject of death. And this evening, we're turning in Romans chapter 2 to think about the subject of judgment. I suppose if you were to take a random poll of people, the majority of people in our country think of death either, one, as the end, simply a brick wall in which biological life comes to its end, and because all they believe that there is biological life. You live your 70 years, or perhaps a few more, and you are simply gone. You do not go anywhere because you did not come from anywhere. You do not live forever because there is nothing immortal about you. And so you die, and death is the end. From the Bible's point of view, of course, that is a horrendous error in thinking. But there is another way. I suspect it is actually still by far the more common way of thinking about death. I could put it briefly like this. When you die, you go to heaven. You go into the presence of God, and the reason he accepts you in his presence is simply because you have died. If you were to analyze the gospel, which most people in Scotland, whether they make any kind of Christian profession or not, actually believe, the gospel they believe is this: that we are justified by dying. There is a very simple way, I think, of showing that that's true. I rather think if you had been in the United States of America during the month of September, you would have been given extraordinary demonstrations of that truth. That these several thousand people who died in the Twin Towers are in heaven. Why? Because they have died. Look a little further back into what I suppose emotionally is the analogy in the history of our own recent country. The death of Princess Diana. People with no Christian profession, little Christian knowledge, appearing on the media, weeping in the streets, and giving extraordinary expression to the fact that, of course, she was in heaven because, after all, she had died. And when you come closer to home, and often as ministers of the Christian faith do, meet with people who are bereaved, the common expressions that are used by people who really have no Christian faith whatsoever is, he or she has gone to a better place. All is now at peace. All is now well. And sometimes, for somebody who really believes the Christian gospel, the most cutting and grievous thing of all, he or she is in a better place. But on what grounds? Simply because they have died. It's because of these two errors. Error number one, that death is the end. Error number two, that death itself makes somebody who all their lives has been utterly unacceptable to God and cared little about God, suddenly acceptable to God, and with a heart throbbing with worship of God. Somebody who has hated the thought of worshiping God with his people, who simply by dying suddenly discovers that they intensely love to worship God with his people. The greatest heresy of the Western world is the heresy that we are acceptable to God simply because we have died. That is why one of the great verses, one of the most famous statements in the whole of the New Testament, in a book that is, to most of us, relatively speaking, unfamiliar, comes in the words of Hebrews chapter 9, verse 27. It is appointed for us once to die, and after that comes judgment. It's often said, it's certainly been often said to me in circumstances discussing death, discussing the future, the conversation will end a little defensively by somebody saying, well, of course, the Bible has almost nothing to say about what happens after we die, and we don't know very much about it. When the fact of the matter is, that there are very few things that the Bible has more to say about, is more profoundly concerned about. There is actually nothing that the Lord Jesus Christ was more passionate about than giving the answer to the question, what happens after we die and what are going to be the consequences of it? Because, as these words in Hebrews 9:27 tell us, after death comes God's judgment. That's why this evening I want us to look a little at these verses in Romans chapter 2, which are, as John said a moment ago, entitled in the New International Version, God's Righteous Judgment, and are rightly so titled because even a moment's glance at the opening verses will indicate to you that judgment is their theme. The word is used, I think, on at least six occasions in the first three verses. You who pass judgment. You who pass judgment. We know that God's judgment. Who are you, a mere man, passing judgment? Do you think you will escape God's judgment? And again, in verse 5, he speaks about God's judgment. And here, as those of us who were here on Friday night and most of the day, Saturday morning and Saturday afternoon, will easily remember, the Apostle Paul is turning to people who are strikingly similar to most of us, who have listened to his condemnation of the lifestyle of pagan, ungodly people, who live somewhere out there in the moral darkness, and openly, in ways that make decent people cringe, openly flaunt the law of God. And we speak critically of them. We make judgments on them. And in this passage, Paul is turning to people just like that. He's actually turning to any human person who at any time in their lives has looked at somebody who is failing, who is sinning, who is breaking the moral etiquette of Western society and has had just an ounce of condemnation in their hearts and of judgment in their hearts for them. And he is saying, not notice that your judgment is erroneous, but rather, who are you to judge when you yourself are in precisely the same situation? And in these verses, the Apostle Paul summarizes what the Bible has to say about God's judgment, basically by saying two things concerning it. Number one is that the judgment of God is absolutely accurate. It is a precise, a precision judgment. Now, you and I make judgments all the time. It's really not possible to live for more than a few minutes, if even that, unless you're simply lying in your bed, and even then you're making a judgment about the fact that it's good for you. There's just a constant flow of judgments pass through our minds. You go to the supermarket and the supermarkets are full of people making judgments. If you'd come from the moon and watched them, you would, I think, have great amusement trying to work out what it was that they were doing. Here is a woman and she's picked up a melon and she's shaking it. She's judging whether it's fresh. She's pressing it. Here, on the other hand, somebody comes to the door. You open the door. You are instantly faced, always nowadays, with a kind of crisis. Unless you immediately recognize the person, you have to make a judgment as to whether this person is trustworthy, whether they are who they are, whether they represent what they say they are. It's not possible to live in any world, certainly not the modern world, without constantly engaging in judgments. And we all do. The person who says, I never engage in judgments, is simply ignorant about the way they themselves are living. We are constantly engaging in judgments, all the time, day by day, hour by hour. But the thing that the Bible wants to make clear, and we need to understand, is that, of course, our judgments are at best partial and at worst horribly wrong. We do not know the full story, and therefore we are not able to make accurate judgments. Not only so, but as you remember, God said to the prophet Samuel when he was looking for a new king who would replace King Saul in the Old Testament. It is characteristic, said God to Samuel, it's characteristic of you humans to judge by outward appearance. Well, of course it is, because we can't see into each other's hearts. We don't understand all the circumstances that have made us what we are. We can't penetrate down to the conflict of motivations that there may be in an individual that draws him or her to do the kind of things they do. Our judgments, at best, are based on partial evidence, external evidence. And of course, at worst, our judgments can be horribly wrong, because we judge by appearance. But here is the difference, says God to Samuel. I judge by looking at the heart. Man judges by looking at external appearance and external action, but I judge by looking at the heart. And in these verses in Romans 2, about this accurate judgment God makes by looking at the heart, Paul says three things. Number one, he says it is based on truth. Now, the word truth in the Bible does not simply refer to propositions, statements that you're able to tick and say, well, that's right, and that's right, and that's right. Like perhaps something that you would do in an exam, that's a correct answer. When Paul says, as he says here in Romans 2:2, that God's judgments are, at the end of the verse, based on truth, or literally according to truth, he means that God's judgments perfectly assess, not whether I'm speaking the truth or not, but perfectly assess the reality of the situation in my particular case. God's judgments are according to the reality. Now, it's very interesting that when he's writing to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, Paul, who was an extraordinarily wise and thoughtful man, and a man of immense discernment, spiritual and psychological, says, I am not even able to do that for myself. And if you know yourself a little, you know that's true. You are simply not capable of judging the motives, of assessing the desires, of penetrating down to the hidden influences that are brought to bear upon the decisions you make and the way you live your life. You're not able to judge yourself according to the truth about yourself, because you don't really yet know the truth about yourself. Sometimes you do something, say something, it's escaped before you're able to bring it back. And in your better moments, you go back quietly to your little room and you say, is that really the truth about me? And you engage in a kind of contest with yourself. Paul actually goes on to speak about it. You begin to argue with yourself. You say, that was so out of character. That wasn't really me. But you know all along the very fact that it escaped from you and from nobody else is an indication that it really was revealing something profoundly true about you that you either didn't know about yourself or you weren't prepared to admit even to yourself was true about yourself. I don't worry about it, but probably I ought to worry about it. I sometimes think about that little bit that functions in our brain and the way our mind works that enables us to keep the things that we're thinking inside rather than speaking them outside. Because what is inside is an extraordinary revelation and we keep the lid on it. I have a very good friend who had a lady in his congregation who hated it when he preached for more than 20 minutes. At 21 minutes she would go, and then at 22 minutes again, if he got to 25 minutes she was going like this. And one day he leaned over the pulpit and he said, pointing at her, he said, it's all right, Mrs. Smith, or whatever her name was. I'll be finished in another 5 minutes. Went to the church door, shook hands, came back to his vestry, and it suddenly dawned on him that what he had thought almost every single Sunday morning since he had gone to the church had actually come out of his lips. And we are like that, aren't we? Thankfully, it's as well that we're not like some of these things in your computer where suddenly this bubble comes up, and if there were bubbles that came up, you know, like in the cartoons, from every thought that went through your mind about other people, well, you see, you wouldn't be able to show your face in public, would you? And Paul is saying that the judgment of God penetrates right down to the truth about our lives. And not only so, you'll notice he goes on to say, it's not only based on truth, but in verse 11 he says very clearly, it does not involve any favoritism. That's really scary, isn't it? It doesn't involve any favoritism. Every single one of us in this room recognizes that every judgment that we make in certain contexts is invaded by favoritism. We get on well with people. These are our family. We don't like that person. Actually, the language that Paul uses here is a Hebrew-type expression that means kind of lifting up the face towards somebody. And he's saying God's judgment has nothing of that kind. It is perfectly accurate, and there is nothing in God that will tilt him. You cannot bribe him. He does not have a price in this matter of his judgment. And then, says Paul, thirdly, this judgment which God administers is a righteous judgment. It's based on truth. It has no favoritism about it. And in verse 5, it is an absolutely righteous judgment. Now, the word righteous or righteousness in the Bible is a word that means it conforms to a norm. It meets a certain standard. And when Paul says that God's judgment is a righteous judgment, what he's really saying is this, that the judgment of God in a man or a woman's life is a judgment that perfectly reflects the actual moral reality of that person's life. And his judgment, by which he means not only the fact that he will say guilty or not guilty, but all the consequences of that guilty or not guilty, that judgment of God will perfectly mirror the reality of my life. In chapter 1, verse 18 to 32, as some of us saw yesterday, it must have been, he gives a very interesting illustration of how this works. He says, here are these people, and they are flaunting the laws of God, and God is exercising his judgment upon them. He is exercising his judgment upon them. But they look up into God's face, they look into the eyes of Christians and say, you Christians say that if we live in this way, God will demonstrate his just and righteous judgment against us according to truth. But we are living in this way and there is no hindrance to us flaunting the laws of God. And you see, Paul comes back and he says, that's my very point. My point is that the judgment of God upon your sinfulness so mirrors your sinfulness that he simply gives you over to all the ghastly consequences of that sinfulness. His judgment perfectly fits, perfectly meets the crime, the sin. And in that sense, he underlines in verse 11 that God's judgment is always a righteous judgment. And so it leads, as he's already pointed out in chapter 1, in verse 24, in verse 26, and verse 28, he uses exactly the same expression. It issues in God's judgment being issued in a penal way, in a legal way, and he uses a legal term, by God handing us over to the consequences of our sinfulness. God handing us over to the consequences of our sinfulness. The verb that he uses here, he wrote his letter to the Romans in the Greek language. The verb he uses is the same verb that's used, for example, of Jesus being handed over to Pontius Pilate for the legal Roman trial that would eventually lead to his execution. And Paul is saying, essentially, our lives are constantly on trial before this Almighty, this Holy God. And his judgment upon these lives will be perfectly accurate and perfectly legal and will involve us being handed over, he says, to an appropriate judgment. Indeed, so confident is he of this that he goes on to say in verses 14 and 15, to which I've already alluded, really, that our own consciences stand up within our own lives and say, God is right. God's judgment is true. Here he speaks about people who don't have the Bible, who didn't have the Old Testament. And he says, nevertheless, they are conscious of the fact because they've been made as the image of God and can't escape the fact that they've been made to be like God, to live as human men and women in a way that reflects the moral character of God because we've been made to live that way. It's been installed in us, as it were, from our very creation. He says, whenever we deviate, there is that conscience, Jiminy Cricket, that sounds in our ears and condemns us. Or if perhaps we are able to be obedient, says, yes, that is the right way. And there is no man or woman, no boy or girl, who hasn't received in his or her very being that echo of the judgment of God. But until we find some way of silencing the voice of conscience somehow or another, or so inebriating conscience, so satiating conscience, so filling conscience with other things, it constantly stands as God's echo in our souls to tell us that God's judgment upon our lives is absolutely accurate. So his judgment is perfect. It is absolutely accurate. But the second major thing Paul says about this judgment is that it is also intensely personal. That is to say, God's judgment is not just given en masse, Glaswegians, or men. We make those judgments. These people from Edinburgh, or conversely, those people from Glasgow, women or men or husbands, you walk down the street and it said, you could, I suppose several times a day if you walked around the city centre, you would just hear that one word, husbands. Because of our experience, we tend to judge in the mass. But God does not judge in the mass. He judges individually. Look at what he says in verse 6. He says, when God's righteous judgment will be revealed at the end of verse 5, he says this. Then verse 6, God, and he's quoting from the Old Testament, from Psalm 62, same words in Proverbs 24. God, he says, will give to each person according to what he has done. God judges individuals. That means that every single one of us sitting here and me standing here in the church this evening will be judged by God as individuals. You will be, if you are married, judged for what you have been to your husband or to your wife. If you have belonged to a family, you will be judged for how you have responded to father or mother, brother or sister, son or daughter. But you will not be joined to any other single human being when you stand before the judgment seat of God. It will not be possible then, men, to nudge your wife forward and say, you speak for us. It will not be possible, women, for you to say, I'm his wife. It will not be possible for us as children to say, I'm their son, I'm their daughter. Yes, all of these things will be part and parcel of the evidence on which God judges my life. But when God comes to judge my life, he will judge my life absolutely as an individual, each one. Yes, it's true, as Jesus says in Matthew in chapter 25, that God will gather all the nations before his judgment seat. But he will not judge the nation and then, in the light of that, parcel out your share of national judgment. Every one of us, he says, will appear before the judgment seat in order to receive what is due us while we have been in the body. For many years now, since I was a student, I've been fascinated by the life story of the great Danish philosopher, theologian of the first part of the 19th century, Søren Kierkegaard. Do you know what he wanted put on his tombstone? One word, the individual. And he was right, at least in this, that while we live in communities, while we depend upon one another here upon the earth, when we stand before the judgment seat of God, we will be absolutely alone. And his judgment will be, says the apostle, intensely personal. And on what basis will that judgment, that personal judgment, be made? Well, look at what he says in chapter 2, verse 12. He says, all who sin apart from the law will also perish apart from the law, and all who sin under the law will be judged by the law. Here are the principles of God's judgment. I know it's true that people say, well, we've no idea how God will judge, but you can't read the Bible and say that kind of thing. You certainly can't believe the Bible and say that kind of thing. The Bible makes it so clear the basis on which God will judge us. That is so important for you, for me, as it obviously is so important for our Lord Jesus Christ, that the Bible spells out the principles on which God will judge my life. Principle number one, he will judge me on the basis of what I've known about him. Paul is distinguishing here between people who have had the revelation of God in the Old Testament scriptures and people who haven't. He says those who sin under the law, by which he generally means those who've had the Old Testament scriptures, he's speaking here about Jews, those who sin, although they've had that revelation, will be judged by the law. And those who have not had that law clearly spelled out to them in the revelation of the Old Testament scriptures, you notice he doesn't say that they will not be judged. He says they will be judged. He goes on to make it very clear that although they haven't been given the rewritten form of God's law that was given through Moses at Sinai, they still have the originally written form of God in their very constitution as human beings. That, like an instinct, tells them there is a difference between right and wrong, a difference between what pleases God and displeases God. And no matter how distorted that sometimes becomes in their lives, God has embedded in their very being, as he has embedded in the created order, the point he had made in chapter 1, verses 18 following. He has embedded in the created order outside of them and in the created order inside of them enough revelation about himself for them, as he says in chapter 1, to be absolutely inexcusable for not knowing him, trusting him, loving him, serving him, and seeking to know him better. That's why Paul says the very reverse, in a sense, of what you might expect him to say. You might expect him to say, those who sin under the law, that is, those who have had the revelation of the Old Testament, in which God has made himself so plain, those who sin under the law will perish because they've been disobedient to that revelation. But he doesn't say something as strong as that. He actually believes that, but it's not what he says. He says those who have had that revelation will be judged by the light that they've had. And then he says this, those who sin apart from the law will also perish apart from the law. You see his point? His point is that it will not be possible on that day to stand before God and say, you never made yourself clear. He has made himself clear in the way in which he has created the universe, and he has made himself clear by the echo of his integrity, his moral character, his holiness, and his goodness that has been embedded in you and me as a human being to which our consciences bear witness. So we will be judged according to what we have known, according to what God has revealed to us. And of course, Paul's real point is this, that whether you have had the revelation of God in the Bible, or whether all you have had is the revelation that God has made of himself in the created order and within the instincts of your being, there is no single man or woman who has ever lived, Jesus Christ excepted, but who has failed to respond to the revelation, to the light of the knowledge of God that he has given them. That's why he puts it very negatively in chapter 2, verse 12. All who sin in this way, apart from the law, will perish apart from the law. So he judges us according to the revelation that has been available to us. Number 2, he judges us according to what we have done. Verse 6, God will give to each person according to what he has done. Now the Bible, not just the Bible, our Lord Jesus particularly helps us understand this in a story that he tells in Matthew 25 from verse 31, I think it is, onwards. He portrays all the nations being gathered before him on the great final day of judgment, and him separating, because he is the good shepherd and the great shepherd, he's able to do this. He separates the sheep from the goats. And as you know, and John Rushton would be able to explain the biological details better, sheep and goats certainly in Jesus' day had certain similarities, sometimes a bit more difficult without closer examination to distinguish between them. Jesus distinguishes the sheep from the goats. He says to the goats, depart from me. He says to the sheep, welcome to my Father's kingdom. And then he explains the basis on which he has been able to make that distinction. And here it is. He says, inasmuch as you have done or have not done things, listen to his language, to the least of these, my brothers, you have done it or not done it to me. And it's even more interesting that people then, Jesus pictures them responding as saying, but when? Jesus said, if you've come and visited somebody who's in prison, you've given something to somebody who is in need, who has been a brother of mine, then you have done that for me. And they say, but we didn't see you. We didn't understand. Of course, that's precisely the point. The standard of the judgment of God upon my life is not how I have responded when I have recognized people who have been worthy of my response. The standard of God's judgment upon my life is how I have responded when I haven't even been conscious that I've been responding. You see, we may imagine that we can say to God, well, God, I did this and I did this and I did this. Consciously, I did all these things. You wouldn't be able to remember them if you had done them consciously. But in a sense, the real revelation of who you are in the presence of this all-seeing God is not so much what you do consciously, but what you have done instinctively, what you have done unconsciously, what you have done responsively, immediately. Because that usually tells you far more about a person than what they do as the result of careful clinical calculation. So we are judged on the basis of the revelation we've received. We are judged on the basis of what we have actually done. This judgment of God is intensely personal also in this sense, that the judgment of God penetrates to the things that have been kept hidden and secret. Verse 16, this judgment will take place on the day when God will judge men's secrets through Jesus Christ, as my gospel declares. He will judge your secrets. Down into the very depths of your being, the things I have managed to keep hidden from you, the things you've managed to keep hidden from me, which in both instances, possibly mercifully, are multitudinous. He knows them, he sees them, he penetrates to the depths, and on the basis of the secrets, God's judgment will take place. So God's judgment is absolutely accurate, and God's judgment of our lives is intensely personal. And you only need to read through not only Romans 2, 1 to 16, but move on to chapter 3 to realize that Paul assumes in everything that he says that there is no human being, Jesus Christ apart. There is no human being who on his or her own will have a favorable judgment rendered in their case. And unless you grasp that, there will never be any room in your thinking, in your feeling, in your affections, in your emotions, in your psychology, or in your soul for the Christian gospel. If you don't believe that, the Christian gospel is by and large a pretty neat idea, but it is actually totally irrelevant to you when you stand before the judgment seat of God. Until you realize that when you stand before the judgment seat of God, given what you have been, who you are, and what in the future you may accomplish, you are a lost man or a lost woman. There isn't the remotest chance that thinking that way you will ever, 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 ever be able to understand why Jesus came into the world. Because he did not come into the world, to be a great moral teacher. He came into the world to be a great savior. And it's when it dawns on me that standing before the judgment seat of God, what I need is not a book of instruction, but a savior. But the glory of the Christian gospel begins to dawn upon me. Well, what is our response to this? It's very important to ask, what is our response to this? Let me very quickly give you some typical responses. I have got nothing to hide. I have got nothing to hide. Well, is that really true? Do you think that your little equivalent of the fig leaf that Adam and Eve covered themselves with, hiding from the presence of God and hiding from each other, is going to stand the all-seeing gaze of God? I was reading the other day a story I'd read before about Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the author of the great Sherlock Holmes stories. Just as a joke, really, Conan Doyle one day sent 12 telegrams to a group of extremely respectable people living in London and said, in these telegrams, the secret is out. By the next night, 6 of them had left the country. I have a very interesting, good, but just marginally eccentric friend who was at a conference, a huge conference of broadcasters in the United States, and just for the devilment of doing it, and also because he was a very considerable mimic, he phoned up one of the better-known broadcasters, used the voice of one of the other better-known broadcasters, and said in that mimic, he said, "They've discovered the truth about us. We'll need to meet." And he mentioned that they would meet in another hotel, and said that he was to go downstairs in this huge hotel they were in, get the first taxi that came and go. And then my friend sat at the window up in the 12th floor and watched where the taxi rank was. And sure enough, 10 minutes later, the fellow appeared and he was off in the taxi. And you and I would be the same. Unless you are radically different from me and radically different from everybody else in this room, it would not be possible for you to function if there were one single person here who divulged the secrets of your life. I mean, the real secrets of your life. And so when you say, "I have nothing to hide," you need to remember the wiser response of the psalmist when he says in Psalm 130, "Lord, if you were to mark up my sins, there isn't the remotest possibility I would stand before you. You have everything to hide before the judgment seat of God." Well, you may say, "Well, that one didn't work too well. Here's another one. It was all in the past. It was all in the past." Yes, but you see, the problem is, what the Bible tells us is that everything that's in the past is also in the books. I've had the misfortune of having had to get a new computer recently that is so much more powerful, so much more sophisticated, and infinitely more irritating than my previous computer, confirming the great adage that to err is human and really to foul up takes a computer. And I am just amazed as I discover, as this thing opens up before me, as I press the wrong button and opens up before me, deep secrets that it seems to contain. That it seems to have remembered absolutely everything I've ever done on it so far. The books in heaven are like that. And one day they will be opened. And the past and the present and the future will be gathered together in one. And nothing, absolutely nothing, will have been erased. It will not be possible on that day to say, "Well, it was all in the past." Well, you may say, "That may be true, but I've been better than most. I've been better than most." I don't know how you do that. I don't know by what calculation you know that you have been better than most. But here's an interesting thing. Did you know that some time ago they did one of these stop you in the streets and ask how you're doing kind of things? They discovered that I think it was 92% of male drivers consider that they're better than average drivers. 92% of male drivers consider that they are better than average drivers. And you don't meet too many people who think they are worse than average, do you? I mean, we have different kinds of self-image. I'm not as good-looking, or I'm not as clever, I'm not as this, or I'm not as... You know, but I mean as whole people. Not many of us think that we're below average. Most of us regard ourselves as far above average. Really, far above average. Better than most. Well, the Bible tells us no matter how much better you may be than most, you have fallen far short of God and His glory and His infinitely perfect standards. And it's not possible. This is, you know, there may be somebody in the church tonight for whom this is the absolutely key thing to grasp. God does not judge us